Welcome to session 407, Navigating the Past, the work of the Brown University Steering Committee on Slavery and Justice. I'm Holly Snyder, the North American History Librarian at the Brown University Library, a position I've held since March of 2005. Previous to that, I have been interim university archivist from July of 2004 until just last week. Our session today consists of one speaker, Jim Campbell, who I will shortly introduce. Jim will speak for about 30 minutes. I will follow up with a five-minute comment from the archivist perspective, and that should leave us about 20 minutes, I hope, for questions and comments. As I will not need to explain to those of you who have worked on a college or have had contact with a college campus, the issue of institutional racism in the United States and elsewhere, though hotly debated over the course of the last three decades, is just as contentious today as it was when it first arose in the 1970s. Though its rhetorical focus has shifted in recent years toward the topic of reparations for slavery. In 2001, for example, three doctoral candidates at Yale University produced a report on Yale's complicity in the institution of slavery, which took the university to task for its practice of naming campus facilities after prominent slaveholding administrators and alumni and donors. Though the report has been criticized for factual errors during the 5 years since it was first issued, it remains a rallying point for those critical of the Yale administration, including its graduate students, undergraduates, faculty, and unionized staff. 1 year after the release of this report, advocates for monetary reparations filed suit against the Fleet Bank and two other major corporations, charging that they had profited from slavery by virtue of the investments made by their predecessor institutions, active in financing plantation, that is, slave agriculture, in the period prior to the Civil War. One of these banks, these predecessor banks for Fleet, had been established by members of the Brown family, which gave the case a tangential link to the history of Brown University. It was in this context that in April of 2003, Brown President Ruth Simmons determined to take the bold step of establishing a steering committee to investigate the university's connections to slavery and the slave trade, as well as the potential for reparations. Handpicked and representing Brown's faculty, graduate students, undergraduates, and administrators, the Steering Committee for Slavery and Justice was charged by President Simmons with organizing, and here I am quoting from her letter of charge, academic events and activities that might help the nation and the Brown community think deeply, seriously, and rigorously about the questions raised by the controversies over slavery and reparations, whether they were legal, moral, or historical. Her aim and the committee's goal has thus not been to arrive at a consensus, but rather to present the campus with factual information and critical perspectives, and ultimately to encourage a deeper understanding around the sensitivities of race in the United States. Of all the faculty at Brown who might potentially have chaired such a committee, it is perhaps only natural that she selected our speaker today, Jim Campbell. Jim arrived at Brown in 1999 as Associate Professor of American Civilization, Africana Studies, and History. Educated at Yale and Stanford, Jim began his teaching career in 1986 as Junior Lecturer in History at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, and then moved on to teach at Stanford and Northwestern before coming to Brown. His first book, Songs of Zion, the African Methodist Episcopal Church in the United States and South Africa, won the Frederick Jackson Turner Prize from the Organization of American Historians, as well as the Carl Sandburg Literary Award for nonfiction. Jim has held a variety of research appointments, including a two-year stretch as senior research officer at the University of Witwatersrand from 1996 to 98, a year as fellow of the Charles Warren Center for American History at Harvard from 2000 to 2001, and a year as fellow of the Center for Comparative Studies on Race and Ethnicity at Stanford University from 2003 to 2004. He has been awarded research grants from the Rotary, Charlotte Newcomb, and Fulbright Foundations, as well as an NEH summer stipend. He has published a number of significant works in both article and book form, most recently the monograph Middle Passages, African American Journeys to Africa, 1787 to 2005, just out this year from Penguin Putnam. It is an honor indeed to introduce to you James T. Campbell, Chair of the Brown University Steering Committee on Slavery and Justice.
Thank you. That's extremely kind and too kind. And I just have to say one thing about being chair. Everyone assumes that Ruth Simmons appointed me to be chair. She left the appointment of the chairmanship to the committee, and I was the person who said no only three times. Others on the committee said no only four. And but I'm grateful for the introduction. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the committee, a little bit about the issues and the contexts that we've been investigating, and also to talk, given the audience, about sources and documents and what some of the power of documents can be in revealing truths that are, to paraphrase our late vice president, inconvenient. As Holly mentioned, Ruth Simmons appointed a steering committee on slavery and justice. She asked us not only to investigate our institution's historical relationship to slavery and the slave trade, but to investigate comparative and historical contexts which might illuminate that and encourage robust exchanges of ideas. Over the last 3 years, we have had over 100 speakers on our campus talking about everything from the South African Truth and Reconciliation process to the abduction and forced assimilation of Aboriginal children, to the slave trade, the Underground Railroad, a whole variety of topics that might illuminate the predicament both of our university and of our nation. In addition, the steering committee worked with an agency, the Choices Program at Brown, to produce a curriculum, which we have distributed free to all the high schools in the state of Rhode Island, called Forgotten History, New England Slavery and the Slave Trade. We've also, with undergraduate students, produced a museum exhibition called also Navigating the Past, The Voyage of the Slave Ship Sally, which is what I'll be talking about today, that is in the process now of a 2-year tour of public libraries across the state of Rhode Island. Other versions of the exhibit have also been hung in the John Brown House, a historical house in Providence owned by one of the owners of the Sally, and also in a museum in Antigua, which was the West Indian island where survivors of the Sally were eventually sold. The fact of a slave ship departing from Rhode Island in 1764 was not unusual, although it's interesting the particular ship I'm going to be talking about today, because it was sent by four prominent Providence merchants, Nicholas, Joseph, John, and Moses Brown, who were among the important benefactors of my university. Brown University, originally the College of Rhode Island, acquired its current name only a generation later, in the early 1800s, in recognition of a gift from Nicholas's son, Nicholas Jr. Nonetheless, the Brown family has a very close relationship historically to our university, and the fact that the four brothers sent a slave ship to Africa in the year of the university's founding seemed to us to be a matter well worthy of further reflection. The fact that a ship would sail from Rhode Island was not unusual. Rhode Islanders dominated the North American portion of the transatlantic slave trade. I want to be careful here. The number of American ships that carried slaves to the New World compared to Portugal, Britain, Spain, France was relatively small. But of those North American ships that carried slaves, about two-thirds, and in some years upwards of 90%, came from a single colony and state, tiny Rhode Island. Overall, Rhode Islanders dispatched at least 1,000 slave ships to Africa, carrying over 100,000 Africans into New World slavery, mostly into sugar colonies of the Caribbean. Rhode Island, in fact, was a central player in the triangle trade. The city of Newport, which some of you I'm sure have visited, which we think of as a playground of the Gilded Age rich. A century before that was the home of 22 rum distilleries, where sugar and molasses produced by slaves in the Caribbean was distilled into rum, carried to Africa to exchange for captives who were carried to the Caribbean to produce more sugar and molasses, to produce more rum, to produce more slaves. By the standards of Rhode Island, the Brown brothers were not major slave traders. The largest Rhode Island family in the trade, indeed the largest family in the trade in America, were the DeWolfs of Bristol, Rhode Island, who in the process of, in a course of 30 years, sponsored over 80 slave voyages. The Browns, however, were not strangers to the institution. In 1736, the brothers' father, Captain James Brown, dispatched a ship, the Mary, the first slave ship to sail from Providence to Africa, carried a cargo to the West Indies. In 1759, two of the brothers and their uncle, Obadiah, sent another ship, the Wheel of Fortune, to Africa. This ship, sent in the middle of the Seven Years' War, was captured by a French privateer, making it a severe financial setback for the Brown family, though it wouldn't have made much difference to the slaves on board, who presumably were simply taken to the French rather than the British Caribbean. In 1764, with the Seven Years' War over, the Browns decided to take another crack at it, and the result was the voyage that I'm going to discuss today. I have a few slides just by way of preliminaries. One of the things that was sort of interesting, as Holly sort of discreetly noted, this is a subject of some controversy. And one of the things that I learned very early in it was that if you're a member of a university that says you think it's incumbent on your university as a university to take a serious, sustained look at its own past, lots of people send you emails. I want to share a couple with you. Overall, we've got about 500. I should actually tell you, the report of the committee will be out, God willing, this fall. It will come out in a printed version, also in an online version. The online version will include an awful lot of supplementary materials, including several hundred letters that were sent to the committee, as well as all of the documents of the Sally. The voyage I'm about to show you is, in fact, not only one of the most disastrous, but one of the most comprehensively documented voyages of the over 30,000 transatlantic slaving voyages of which we're aware. There are about 200 manuscript pages from different archives relating to this voyage, all of which we have digitized, transcribed, prepared annotations and introductions for, and all of which will then accompany the report when it's released, making it possible for people all over the world effectively to take a virtual voyage on a slave ship. This particular letter pleased me greatly, as you could imagine. It came from the public affairs director of one of our peer institutions. And I wrote him back and I said he wouldn't mind expressing those sentiments in a press release, would he? And he didn't reply. This is a bit more typical. Now, as a historian, it's actually the second statement that probably interests me more. First of all, just as a matter of technicality, most of the slaves who were carried on Rhode Island ships were not carried legally. In fact, in 1787, Rhode Island became the first state in the Union to make it a crime for its citizens to participate in the transatlantic slave trade. Rhode Islanders were also influential in the passage of federal legislation in 1794 and in 1800, which made it a crime for Americans to carry slaves to foreign ports. If you remember your junior year in high school Constitution class, there was a slave trade clause which said that Congress couldn't prohibit importation of slaves into the United States for at least 20 years after the Constitution. But it could and did prohibit Americans from carrying slaves to foreign ports before finally abolishing the trade altogether in 1807. All of those laws were spectacularly abused, neglected, and ignored by Rhode Islanders in all about half of the ships, not half the ships, about 40% of the ships, and half of the captives in the Rhode Island portion of the slave trade were trafficked illegally. But more important than that, what this sentiment suggests is that the case isn't closed at all, that slavery continues to arouse great passions and unresolved feelings in our nation. And in an odd way, this person's sentiments, and I received lots more like this, suggest just how important a commission like this might be. Universities have portraits of their founders all over the place. To be a member of a university is to be a member of a community that exists across time, to be part of a procession that continued before any of us were born and will continue long after, which seems to me to be primary justification for why a university should be doing the kind of work we're doing. One of the reflections of what universities are like is we have lots of pictures of dead people around our campus. again, reflecting our sense in that community across time, here's one. This is a man named Isaac Hopkins. He was a trustee of Brown University, brother, in fact, of a Rhode Island governor and first chancellor of Brown, Stephen Hopkins. He was the first commander, Isaac was, as you can tell from his uniform, the first commander-in-chief of the United States Navy, a member of the Rhode Island State Legislature. There's a public school in Rhode Island, in Providence, named after him, as well as a park and a street. He was also the captain of the Sally. I'll show you another portrait. This one, actually, somebody want to hit the lights, or if you can find them? I don't know where they are. This portrait you can't see very well, but it's worth having a closer look at perhaps afterwards. As important as the triangle trade was to the economy of Rhode Island, far more important was a bilateral trade with the sugar plantations of the West Indies in Central and South America. Sugar plantations produced one thing. They produced sugar. I guess sugar and dead Africans. And average life expectancy of a slave in the Caribbean was about 7 years. Everything else that was necessary for a colony was imported. The staple diet of a Caribbean slave was salt cod. Salt cod harvested off the coasts of New England, packed in barrels hewn from Rhode Island lumber and carried in Rhode Island ships. Hay, horses, Narragansett pacers were much prized by Caribbean planters. Tobacco, timber, tar, virtually everything, furniture, necessary for a colony was imported. In 1758, a dozen or so Rhode Island ship captains, finding themselves in the Dutch colony of Suriname at the same time, said, you know, we really got to get a picture done. It's the Gary Hart moment. On those occasions when you think you've had a few drinks and you want to have a picture done, it's probably best not to do it. This picture, called Sea Captains Carousing in Suriname, is by John Greenwood from 1758. It now hangs in the St. Louis Museum of Art. There's some dispute among art historians about whether the figure in the upper right corner is vomiting, urinating, or both. You'll see one man, while lighting his backside on fire, vomiting in the pocket of his sleeping companion. You see several slaves rendered half naked and chiefly as children serving the people in the process of their bacchanalia. This is not the kind of portrait that usually hangs around universities. Six of the people who've been identified of the 10 in that portrait were trustees of my university, including Isaac Hopkins. Two of them would go on to become governors of the state. Again, in 1764, this slide didn't produce very well, I apologize. In 1764, the Brown brothers decided to send the Sally. This document in the John Carter Brown Library, I mean, given that this is archivists, I should tell you this. One of the things about the Browns, why so much attention has been devoted to the Browns, is not that they were the premier slave traders in the state, they weren't the premier slave traders in their city, but because they were the most meticulous record keepers of any colonial firm. That is literally the case. There are somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 separate manuscript pages of Brown family enterprises, all of which are deposited on our campus in the John Carter Brown Library. It is literally the case that if you bought a cup of sugar from a Brown family business in 1750, I can tell you the date, your name, and what you paid, which makes it possible to reconstruct their activities with very rare precision. This is the crew list. This is where people signed on for the Sally. It specifies their dates of signing on, their dates of signing off, and their wage. Again, I apologize that it didn't reproduce well. At the top, you see Isaac Hopkins' master. His wage was £50 a month, although it was also the custom to pay slave ship captains a commission, what was called a privilege. Standard privilege on a Rhode Island ship was 4 on 104. Just to say that for every 104 slaves you delivered alive, you were able to sell 4 on your own account. Hopkins was offered a more liberal privilege, including 10 barrels of rum on the outbound journey and 10 slaves on the return. If you look third from the bottom, you'll see Edward Abbey, Negro boy, £30 a month. There was an African or an African-American who was in the crew of the Sally, although it now is clear from other stuff that we transcribed that he was, in fact, Isaac Hopkins' slave because his wage is paid into Hopkins' account. We have dozens of documents of fitting out a ship. Fitting out a slave ship involved the energies of an entire community. Local rope walks and sail lofts made the rigging and canvas. Caulkers scraped the hulls. blacksmiths, blockmakers, ironmongers fitted out a ship, carpenters prepared the hold, and so forth. Again, we can tell if somebody, loaded 12 loaves of bread onto the ship the day before it departed, and indeed that happened, we have the invoice for it. I chose this particular list of stores. This is one page of a six-page document where right before the ship left, they wrote down everything that was on it. And what's interesting about this is it includes references to those items that were loaded on the ship in order to control the cargo. If you think about the imagination or the imaginary images we have of the slave trade, they involve people lying passively in the hold of a ship. People who sailed these ships knew better. Insurrections were extremely common in the transatlantic trade. Probably 10% of ships at least had an insurrection sufficient to produce at least one fatality. So here you see, for example, 7 swivel guns, guns that could swivel outboard or inboard into the area where slaves were exercised, powder, small arms, 40 handcuffs and shackles. It was the custom on slave ships generally, including Rhode Island ships, that men were housed in a separate compartment from women and children. And while women and children generally had the run of a ship, men were usually shackled, typically 2 at a time at wrist and at ankle, and then a chain would be shot through at night. This is the bill of lading for the Sally, specifying what's on it. And again, it gives you a sense of how many sort of different interests are involved here. 1,800 bunches of onions. Onions were a very important trade good in the transatlantic trade. 30 boxes of spermaceti candles. The Brown brothers owned the nation's premier spermaceti candle works. Candles that were fine candles that burned bright and smokeless were the premier form of illumination at the time, manufactured out of the head matter of whales, usually harvested out in Nantucket. And most importantly in the cargo, 17,274 gallons of New England rum. Well, one of the things that you tried to do if you were a slave ship captain was you tried to get in and out quickly. There's a reason for this. While you're close to shore, obviously the danger of insurrection is greatest, and there's also wastage of your cargo. There's also extremely high mortality of European crew. And in some cases, owners cared considerably less about it since it didn't cost them anything. Europeans had no prior immunity or exposure to diseases endemic to the West African coast, chiefly mosquito-borne diseases like malaria and yellow fever, although they simply would have called them African fever. People knew that when the rains came, the fevers came. So you tried to get in and out as quickly as you could. Now, you couldn't simply drive up and order 200 slaves. What a ship would do is it would coast. It would work its way down perhaps 100 miles of coast, stopping at river mouth, sometimes at major fortresses, sometimes at simply a kind of, ramshackle wood holding pen at a river mouth, bartering for such slaves as you could acquire. If you were lucky, you might get in and out in 2 or 3 months. Rhode Island ships, which tended to be smaller than the massive ships sailing out of Liverpool, if you've seen the cutaway of the Brooks, where slaves are stacked like cordwood, those were the great ships out of Liverpool, which might carry 600 or 700 people. Rhode Island ships tended to be much smaller, so they could usually get off the coast more quickly. Not in the case of the Sally. Everyone else had the same idea at the time, at the end of the 7 Years' War, that they could make a quick killing in the slave trade because of the backlog of demand after the war. 27 ships from Rhode Island alone sailed that season. By the time Hopkins got to the coast, it was awash in rum and slave ships. It ultimately took him over 9 months to acquire a cargo. There are Africans in the hold of the ship for 9 months before it's even left the coast. This is a standard letter of instructions from the Brown brothers to Hopkins, you being master and factor of our brigantine Sally, instructing him to proceed to the windward coast of Africa to acquire a cargo of slaves with quick dispatch, to sell them in the West Indies or wherever they can be sold to best advantage, returning to Providence with 4 likely lads aged about 15 years for the family's own use. This is a very conventional document. The language is very conventional, so you'll find innumerable of these just with the details altered. This is a very interesting one. This you can see, it's June I'm sorry, I beg your pardon, November of 1764. He's been on the coast for about a month. He's acquired slave number 25, or enslaved African, I should say, number 25. This is a very interesting page. The students who worked with me to put together this museum exhibit, we had an argument about whether to include an image of this, because this is the image which shows most clearly African participation in the trade. And I felt that this was such a complicated issue and one so easily distorted that we were best to leave it aside. And the students, in retrospect, I think rightly, insisted on including it. But what you can see is that at this moment, those people who were selling slaves had considerable leverage over those who were trying to acquire them. So if you look, November 21st, waited on the king with two barrels of rum and one keg of snuff for him and his officers. The next day, once again, entertained the entire retinue, the king and his officers, on board the ship. The next day went ashore to negotiate with the king at the palaver tree, bringing along with him five kegs and 11 flasks of rum. These kegs are about 110 gallons each, two 55-gallon drums. Waited on the king, waited on another king, waited on the king's son, paid him his customs, high constable, geographer, alcalde, owner of the fountain, and so forth. During a period of nearly a week, Hopkins dispensed literally hundreds of gallons of rum, in which time the king consented to sell him exactly one captive. Now, what's interesting about this document, there's lots of things interesting in this document. One of the things, these are all from Hopkins' account book, and you can literally see every transaction on the African coast and every captive who was acquired and what was traded for him or her. So if you look in the top left on June 4th, you can see he trades the equivalent of what were called bars, 96 bars, for his 107th captive. Bars were actually an equivalency that was used on the coast because of the variety of currencies that were operating there. A bar was an iron bar, and a small one was one, and a large one was two, but everything else is denominated in bars, and then you bartered over what would put together whatever the price in bars of a captive would be and what your goods constituted in bars to match this. So three kegs and 11 flasks of rum, that's 41. So each keg of rum is 10, obviously. 12, I presume, yards of cloth, guns, three large and three small iron bars, that's nine, and so forth. Totaling 96 bars for a boy slave, 197. June 8th was, in fact, his most successful day on the coast. He acquired for 78 bars a woman slave, number 108, and then the longboat returned from upriver with another 10. On this date, he acquired 11 captives. If you look at the very bottom of the left column, however, it also says, a Begwa woman slave hanged herself between decks, number 2, entered in the debit column. This is Hopkins' final day on the coast. He has acquired now a total of 196 captives. If you look in the right on the debit column, you'll see number 20, one woman almost dead, give to Anthony the Linguister. He's basically paying off the translator, who probably have been Luso-African, Afro-Portuguese, who'd served as the translator on board ship. And on that day, August 20th, the Sally set sail for the West Indies. August 21st, one girl slave died, number 21. August 25th, one boy slave died, number 22. August 27th, one woman and one boy died, 23, 24. 1 week out, August 28th, slaves rose on us, was obliged to fire on them and destroyed 8, and several more wounded badly, one thigh and one ribs broke, 25 to 32. Those two whose injuries are referenced would both die subsequently, one after about 2 weeks, the other after 47 days. After the failed insurrection, Hopkins later wrote, the slaves were so dispirited that some drowned themselves, some starved, others sickened and died. And as you can see, slavery there, death thereafter is virtually a daily event. Indeed, starting on the 30th, I think there's 11 straight days with at least one fatality on the ship. Each fatality carefully recorded in the account book before the bodies would have been tossed into the sea. This is the final page of Hopkins' account book. the Sally arrived first in Barbados and proceeded to Antigua. Those are the first West Indian islands you come to on August 8th, on the same date that slave number 88, the 68th person during the voyage, perished. Although by the time Hopkins had succeeded in selling what remained of his crew in Antigua, another 20 would die as well. And in fact, it's interesting, if you look, December 20th, 6 weeks later, one man slave died, number 109. That is, I think, one of the four likely lads that Hopkins had been asked to bring with him to Providence for the use of the family. It was customary for slave ship captains when they arrived in the West Indies to try to gather local market intelligence to figure out where prices were highest, where the harvest might be coming in, where other slave ships might have recently gone. Hopkins simply sold all of his slaves in Antigua. In a letter to the Brown brothers, he said that had I gone to sea with this cargo, all of them would have died. These are bills of sale from merchants in Antigua who handled some of the sales. The prices are derisory. Of the entire cargo left surviving, two slaves were graded as prime slaves, two Africans, each of whom sold for £50. In this auction, you'll see some people are selling for as little as £4, £5, or £6, which suggests something about the condition they're in. It was actually a kind of junk market, junk bond market, what was called a refuse slave market, that operated in the slave trade, where certain people would specialize in buying slaves that were very cheap because they were in very, very poor health, with the notion that if you could buy 10 for the price of two, but nurse two or three of them back to health and sell them, you could get a fine return on your investment. And that's clearly, some of these are what would have been called refuse slaves. This is another auction, sales of 24 Negroes on account and risk of Nicholas Brown and Company merchants in Rhode Island. Again, the prices are very low. This particular merchant, in fact, wrote a letter of condolence to the Brown brothers. He says, "Enclosed, you have my accounts," he says, "for which slaves was very indifferent," i.e., in very poor health. He goes on to say, "I am truly sorry for the bad voyage you must make. Had the Negroes been young and healthy, I should have been able to sell them pretty well. I make no doubt if you was to try this market again with good slaves, I should be able to give you satisfaction." Well, three of the four Brown brothers did not take him up on the offer. Three of the four, Nicholas, Joseph, and Moses, appear never again to have invested directly in the transatlantic slave trade. It would be nice to say that they were motivated by conscience. What evidence there is simply suggests that they recognized after two failed voyages that the trade was simply too risky. There certainly was very little evidence of remorse in the letter they sent to Isaac Hopkins in Antigua after learning of the ship's fate. "We need not mention how disagreeable the news of your losing three of your hands," just as an interlineation, do you see that? An afterthought. "The news of losing three of your hands and 88 slaves is to us and all your friends, but yourself continuing in health is so great satisfaction to us that we remain cheerful under the heavy loss of our interests." Somebody turn the lights back on. One of the Brown brothers would, in fact, subsequently be stricken by conscience. In 1773, Moses Brown underwent a spiritual conversion brought about by the death of his wife. He converted to Quakerism and threw himself into the embryonic anti-slavery movement. Indeed, he quickly emerged as the most important anti-slavery leader in Rhode Island, and in some cases, I think it's fair to say, in the nation as a whole. He drafted a bill to abolish slavery in Rhode Island in 1774. It failed of passage. But he also drafted Rhode Island's Gradual Abolition Act of 1784, the Anti-Slavery Act of 1787, and was influential in lobbying for federal anti-slave trade legislation in 1793, 4, and in 1800. In fact, Moses Brown went to Washington and had a personal interview with James Madison, who'd written the Constitution, and said, "Well, the Constitution says we can't ban the importation of slaves into American ports. Can we criminalize importing slaves to foreign ports?" Madison said, "Yes, you can." And that bill was, in fact, the only bill ever introduced into Congress by a sitting president, George Washington. It didn't matter in the case of Rhode Island. The abolitionists were regarded as a bunch of fringe religious fanatics, and the trade continued largely unabated. One of the men who continued to participate in the trade and its chief and most vocal defender was Moses' beloved older brother, John, who emerged as the premier defender of the slave trade at the same time as his brother emerged as its most severe critic. The battle between them would rumble not only across our campus, but in the newspapers of Rhode Island, where there was a bitter newspaper war in 1789, in the course of which both anti-slavery people and defenders of the trade cloaked their arguments in the language of the revolution, with Moses and others insisting that this was a nation grounded in principles of equality and unalienable rights, and John and others insisting that the revolution had been fought to defend people's rights to personal property against aggressive governmental authority. As John said in one of those letters, "There is no more wrong in bringing off a cargo of slaves as in bringing off a cargo of jackasses." In 1796, in fact, John Brown would be the first American prosecuted in a federal district court for the crime violating the 1794 anti-slavery law, a prosecution that was brought at the behest of his own brother. This is part of the history that we're trying to explore. And the more you explore it, the more you wonder why everyone wouldn't be interested in talking about it. Thanks very much.
Okay, when Jim and I were talking about what we were going to do for this session, one of the things we thought might be helpful for the audience would be to talk about the library's part in this project. The Sally project that Jim has just presented portions of to you is actually sponsored by the Brown University Library. We will be hosting it as a database project that will exist in perpetuity, as all of our library projects do, so that the information and the research that Jim and members of the steering committee and the students who have worked in the I think it's a two-year-long seminar now on the history of slavery, have uncovered and unpacked, will be accessible for everyone to view nationwide, not just on the Brown University campus. This is part of the Brown University Library's contribution to the work of the University Steering Committee. It's one project among many that we're trying to undertake to support the work of the Steering Committee. And it does give us an opportunity to sort of highlight some of our own digital projects and to make, to highlight what's in the library's collections. One of the things Jim mentioned to you just now was that the documents, some of the documents he was showing were from the John Carter Brown Library, which is not part of the Brown University Library system. It's an independent institution on our campus that was funded by members of the Brown family and therefore holds those early records of the Brown family enterprises. However, the documents that the students have used for the work that they've been doing for the committee have come from a number of different institutions in Rhode Island, including the Brown University Archives, the Rhode Island Historical Society, the Rhode Island State Archives. That's it for now. Okay, well, there are many other institutions that we could be exploring, including the Newport Historical Society down in Newport. And I'm sure at some point the work of the students will expand into those areas. So this website is really a multi-institutional collaboration to pull this project together and make it accessible to everyone. And it also sort of highlights what is really unique in Brown's academic program. Since 1968, the Brown University curriculum has had no requirements for students, so students are completely free to pursue what they're interested in. And I think the students who pursued this project are really just one example of what can be done by Brown students when you wind them up and let them go. You get them interested in something, they will pursue it to the end of the earth. What this has meant for the Brown University Archives. The Brown University archives have traditionally been somewhat underutilized. As those of you who work in a university archive will know, it's really hard sometimes to get the faculty interested. The perception is that a university archive is kind of like institutional navel-gazing. And I think what's been useful to the Brown University archives about our work with the students on this project is that it has opened up faculty perceptions of what kinds of materials are in the Brown University archives and what you can do with them. That doesn't have to do with just focusing on the university, how you can link them to a larger context and unpack larger histories by using those very local documents. So it's helped faculty rethink about what you can do with it. And other faculty are now sending their students into the archives and actively engaging them in working with materials that are in the university archives for various kinds of scholarly projects, whether they focus on the Brown University campus or they have a larger contextual arrangement. And these can be both modern topics, such as campus protests in the 1960s, or they can be historical topics. So it encourages students to design projects also that utilize our holdings, not only for university archives, but alumni papers, which we have a very strong holding of in the Special Collections Library, as well as other manuscript collections, one of which that's being utilized is the Rhode Island ACT UP collection that had been sitting there dormant since it had been donated to us when the group disbanded in the 80s, but now is being used for a project on underground Rhode Island. Another benefit to the archives has been that it's invigorated the students who've now recaptured for themselves a piece of not just the university's history, history of the place where they're studying, where they now are located, but also unpacks for them a broader piece of American history that connects them through the university to a broader past and gets them interested in pursuing American history at other levels. It has also helped us in the library in terms of drawing attention from the university administration to the uniqueness and the range of materials in our collections and the necessity for preserving them for the future. Now, in terms of a broader context of the Brown University Library, we've had a very strong digital leadership since 2001 when we snagged Patrick Yott from the University of Virginia. And we've been growing exponentially in that area since that date in a very organic fashion partly because of our view of our special collections as being primarily a teaching collection. We are a university. We acquired these things not just as museum objects and not just for the highest rank of scholarship, but for scholarship at all levels. And we want undergraduates to come to special collections and engage with these materials. We also had a couple of faculty members early on, and it really only takes just one person to get you started with this, who were interested in going digital with instruction. So a particular faculty member, a colleague of Jim's in the American Civilization Department, Susan Smolian, got interested in our collection of African-American sheet music because she taught a course on minstrelsy. And she wanted to digitize some of this and use the images with the students and have them write essays using this digital database. So we digitized the material for her, and she got the students to write essays, some of which were very good, and we ended up with a digital collection that was not just a set of pretty images of sheet music, but includes student essays. So the students were able to publish their work and show what kind of scholarship they were capable of in a public way. And we had a database that was really functional, not just for people who were looking for African-American sheet music, but for people who wanted to understand the context of the sheet music. Susan's gone on to do a couple of other projects which have really come to be the forefront of our instructional use of digital collections. One involved a scroll in our military collection about Matthew Perry's visit to Japan in 1854, which is the visit that opened up Japan to the West. This was a Japanese scroll prepared by Japanese artists giving their vision of that American visit to Japan, and Susan had her students, again, write essays, which were then published. She then got involved with Japanese universities and found there was an American set of prints of the same visit, and she's got Japanese students now at a Japanese university with a colleague of hers writing essays from their perspective on that that end of the exchange. So this has become a cross-cultural entity, a very dynamic collection now that's being used by people on both sides of the Pacific. In fact, we found out that there's a high school in upstate New York that discovered the site and is now using the collection, and we're starting to post those student essays. And we've now added a collection of Japanese broadsides about Perry's visit to Japan as well as these official documents by artists who accompanied either side of the expedition. In addition to that, Susan used one of the collections in the Brown University archives to document a partnership that rose out of the 1960s when Brown, like other institutions of its stature, partnered with some of the historically black colleges in the South. In the case of Brown, this is Tougaloo College, to really promote freedom and promote education and promote civil rights in the South. The Brown-Tougaloo partnership survived much longer than many of the others, and Susan wanted to go back to Tougaloo with students and document exactly what had been done in the 60s, how the program got started and how it had progressed. And in the process of that, she got her students to go down to Tougaloo and work with the archives at Tougaloo. She had them work in the archives at Brown, and we ended up with a website where students selected documents to digitize and then wrote essays about why they thought these documents were important and put them up on the web as documentation of this arrangement, this unique partnership between Brown and Tougaloo. Okay, so students, we also get digital projects through students who are interested in creating digital theses, whether that's at the undergraduate honors level or a master's thesis or a doctoral dissertation. In that way, we've created digital databases of our Persian miniatures. That became a database cataloging project with images of the miniatures. We have a series of Napoleonic satires that's become a digital image database with interpretive essays by the art historian, the graduate student who started this project with a faculty member. One of our undergraduates got interested in the university's collection of historic clocks and worked with the university curator to create a collections-level database of the university's clocks with lots of historical information about the creators of the clocks. And another graduate student, I think for her PhD, worked on creating a set of indices for a set of six Pan-African journals in French from West Africa. It's called the Liberation Journals Database. This took her years to do, but we now have indices for these six journals that never had been indexed before. So it's a wonderful scholarly tool that she created as part of her doctoral dissertation. We also have a number of library hybrid projects that may have started as a faculty student project, became a library exhibition, and then a full-text database. The Paris Capital of the 19th Century project is one of these that has been taken over by our French studies librarian, but started as a French studies faculty project working with students, as well as library exhibits and digital finding aids. So just to sum all of this up, the work of the University Steering Committee on Slavery and Justice have become part of a broader collaboration of the Brown University Library staff with faculty and students to build dynamic digital collections that are both attractive gateways to our unique content, but also showcase the interests and the scholarship of our faculty and students, and the ultimate aim being to help position the library at the centerpiece of a single dynamic learning environment. Thanks. So we'll be happy to entertain questions from the audience.
The person you're referring to is a woman whose name is Katrina Brown, but it's Brown with an E. She's not a Brown. She's actually a DeWolf. And this is one of the things about Rhode Island. It's very inbred. And what Katrina did, she's making a film about her family. It's called, I think, Traces of the Trade. Should come out soon. And what she did was she invited all living DeWolf descendants to join her in this journey of exploration. I think she wrote to about 250 people, and I think about six of them joined, literally. The Brown family, I don't really know. I think there are still members of the family who live in Rhode Island. I haven't spoken to them.
I can add to that because I had worked on some of the Brown family papers from the 20th century and have had some contact with members of the family. I think they have been, shall we say, nonplussed to see this to see so much made about their connection to the slave trade. And I think it was not just their reaction, but a common reaction among, let's say, a lot of Brown alumni who objected to the idea that the university was going to be dragged through the mud by bringing up this issue. And I think it was very controversial, especially at the outset. As Jim showed you, some of the quotes that he got, we were hearing about that in university archives from alumni who were calling us up and saying, why are you doing that? You know, why are you engaged in that? Why are we going through all of this again? You know, what's the point of this? And I think the point of this is becoming clearer as Jim gets closer to publicizing the final report of the committee. And I think once we get the SALI database up and running, I think people will start to get the point a little bit better. As with any other enterprise, this is what happens.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, on the whole, I've been surprised how smoothly it's gone down. I mean, I think people realized fairly quickly that it was a serious and sustained effort and that it wasn't some kind of madcap gesture. And so it's gone remarkably well. Of course, you know, we're not out of the woods yet.
No, none of the library staff were members of the steering committee. The steering committee consisted of 8 faculty members, 1 graduate student, 3 undergrads, and I think 4 administrators. The library staff and other staff in day-to-day operations at Brown were not invited to participate in the committee. It was designed to be a scholarly committee. But we have been participating in terms of supporting the students, helping them do the research, pointing them to the sources, and willingly so, because it's, as with everything else at Brown, it's a university enterprise, and our collections are being used. I mean, we live to serve the users, and the more people come in and use the archives, the better case we can make for preserving the materials. And in fact, you know, Jim just gave you a tip of the iceberg in terms of what the students have been working on. They've also been looking at the history of the university. We have a document that we have digitized. It's not yet up in the web because we're finishing the EAD finding aid that it's embedded in. But that does document that slave labor was used to build the first university building, which is still the university administrative building where Ruth Simmons has her office, that it was built with slave labor. So there are lots of materials that we have to contribute. Jim and the students have also been looking at advocacy or lack of advocacy of abolition on campus and what that meant, and have been looking at tracing the careers of various Brown alumni to see where they were going and what they were doing and whether, you know, what was their position on slavery and abolition.
Actually, I'll tell you this, because this is one of the things that I think we've tried to do to move it away from simply the question of, you know, how much, you know, money or how much of the endowment of Brown comes from slavery, which is in some ways, you know, the kind of question that Americans are prone to ask. It's I think, at one level, the proportion's fairly small. At another level, the answer is all of it, because everything in the country is implicated in this, which is the, you know, the great American industry for a very long time. But part of what we've also tried to realize is that, you know, the controversy that we're part of today, you know, we're actually re-entering a conversation that went on our campus 200 years ago. Students had debates about this kind of thing. And the fact that some of the most notorious traitors were members of our board of trustees, and some of the founding members of the anti-slavery movement were members of our board of trustees, and that they occasionally met one another in court, makes this all pretty interesting. One of the sources that I thought was fantastic is the University Archives has a kind of collection of random student orations. And one of these that's digitized that we talk about in the report and that we'll put up on the web, there's a commencement address by a senior in 1790. His name is James Talmadge. If any of you are historians, you'll remember the Talmadge Amendment, which is what precipitated the Missouri Crisis in 1820. It's the amendment that says slavery can never again go north of the southern border of Mississippi, stretching out to the west. He's a Brown alum. And in his commencement address in 1790, with some of the nation's premier slave traders sitting in the audience, he basically says, I take as my topic today an infringement on the rights of man, the slave trade. And he works through in sort of every single argument that's being made by proponents of the trade and just derides, demolishes, mocks, shatters them. And including this notion, he says, that people of a fair complexion are superior to people of a darker one. He said, if we push this logic to its extreme, we shall all be ruled by some puny white sovereign. But what's amazing is he says at the end of the thing, he says, you know, the fact that people at this campus can seriously make arguments like that is a subject for future generations to investigate. Yeah, I mean, Ruth Simmons has been very adamant from the get-go that first of all, every one of our programs would be public, and that we would reach out with programs, so hold programs not only on our campus but off campus in schools and school libraries and things like this. We've also been helped a great deal by members of the Rhode Island Black Heritage Society, which has for a long time sort of had a quite lonely crusade for trying to insist on the importance of this history. There was a movement, I mean, the House of John Brown, the person who was the defender of the slave trade, obviously not the John Brown of Harper's Ferry. John Brown, who was the defender of slavery, that house is a Rhode Island Historical Society historic home. And members of the Rhode Island Black Heritage Society fought for years to have a plaque put up outside the home, eventually one, that mentioned that he was a slave trader. That plaque, in fact, has been defaced on several occasions. Now the John Brown House actually has a permanent installation about the Sally. So I think that's been very good. I think the broader question, you know, about outreach is it seems to me, and I think to others on the committee, that one logical set of recommendations that ought to come out of the committee would be in the direction of outreach to ensure that, what have we learned from this? And part of what we've learned is the way in which universities aren't ivory towers. They're deeply implicated in the communities of which they're a part, and that certain obligations flow from that. No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, I think that a couple things. One is, you're right, to read these ship manifests is unbelievable. They're just incredibly powerful. As for the emotional content of this, yes, I think you're absolutely right. And I'm dispassionate deliberately because you don't need me to lay this on. I think the documents are pretty eloquent themselves. So in fact, one of the things I'll just throw it out as an observation, I'd be very interested to hear any of your thoughts. I mean, part of what amazes me about this is how powerful those documents are, how powerful seeing those physical artifacts are. And I think one of the things that's very important, both in the print version, where some of these will be used as illustrations, and in the online version, is that we show these documents. We don't just write about them. And partly, I think that simply, you know, it models the committee's desire to make visible that which has been erased. But there's also a way in which touching those documents, and with digitizing, you almost feel as if you are, allows a possibility of feeling and empathy that you don't otherwise have. If all you had were these transcriptions of these documents, they wouldn't have the emotional resonance that they do. And that interests me greatly. I'm not sure why that is. It's partly that it acquires a reality that it doesn't otherwise have, but it seems to me that's one of the reasons to get students into archives generally, and it's also one of the reasons to get digital images of archival materials along with the transcription so that they're searchable and accessible, but to make sure the original images get up there as well. I think we got time for one more. Yeah, I mean, I part of my own research is on issues about sort of traffic between Africa and America over a long period of time, and I don't have any qualms about saying that slavery existed in Africa and that Africans participated in the transatlantic slave trade, and some of them profited quite handsomely. But it's complicated, and the contexts for understanding that and the kinds of moral judgments that it invites are very complicated. I mean, one of the things you can see it in these records, you know, rum was the main commodity carried by Rhode Island ships. The main trade commodity carried by British ships was guns. I mean, the British, in a 10-year period, the British alone introduced something like 1.5 million small arms into West Africa. Overall, an estimated 20 million guns are sold into West Africa during the years of the slave trade, which, you know, you don't need to be a genius to understand part of what you're doing. And the way in which this puts an onus on on individual polities that, you know, you can pretty much participate in the trade and trade your neighbor, or you can be pretty sure your neighbor's going to be trading you. Now, I don't say that to exonerate, to extenuate. It just seems to me it's complicated. But what happens, and this I've probably got a dozen letters on my computer of people who wrote, who basically say, quote, they sold their own people, close quote. That's the end. I now am absolved of any further reflection, thought, sense of responsibility about this issue. And of course, A, they didn't. Everybody pretty much who's ever trafficked in slaves in history, you always enslave somebody else. That's pretty much the norm. And Africans did. They enslaved other Africans. But that notion that we have, that this is all one group of people, in some sense an artifact of the slave trade. It wouldn't have made much sense to people who were living there. But the point is, it's very complicated, and it invites a certain kind of knee-jerk dismissal. And I knew in a museum exhibition where, you know, you get, you know, a total of 40 words on a panel, that we weren't going to be able to get into it, and I just thought, why do it? And the students insisted, and they were right. They were right.
All right, I think that's all the time we have. The room has to be turned around for the next session, but thank you all very much for coming. If I could just add, we do have a few bookmarks up here of our digital projects from the Brown University Library that you are welcome to take. Please take them. I don't want to take them home.